Welcome to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian Lebeau. This week we continue our second series of special programs on the United States Constitution. The series is based on a project launched by the Bill of Rights Institute titled Founders and the Constitution in Their Own Words, a two-volume collection of materials intended to add to our understanding of the remarkable stories of America's founders. In today's program, we discuss the idea of equality and Thomas Jefferson. But first, let's look at an item of historical interest in the news that relates to another of the nation's great presidents, whose name is also closely associated with the idea of equality, Abraham Lincoln. Just when it seemed we had heard and seen everything there is to know about Abraham Lincoln, two vital, long-lost relics from the past, one verbal and one visual, have unexpectedly surfaced. For years, scholars have known that Lincoln penned a letter in the fall of 1859 to Ohio Senator Thomas Corwin. Two surviving Corwin letters to Lincoln neatly bracket and attest to the missing communication. In the first, Corwin chides Lincoln for allegedly saying in a Cincinnati speech that a moderate Republican presidential candidate would lose Illinois by 50,000 votes in 1860. In the second, written nearly a month later, Corwin notes, "I've received your explanation. 6 months hence, we shall see more clearly what at this time must remain only in conjecture." But what did Lincoln write to Corwin in between? Now we know. The Abraham Lincoln Bookshop in Chicago has purchased the three-page handwritten confidential note long quietly treasured by Corwin's descendants. It offers some of the strongest language Lincoln ever used to defend his party's opposition to slavery. Warning, drop that issue and the voters have no motive to remain and will not remain with us. It's idiotic to think otherwise. Do you understand me as saying Illinois must have an extreme anti-slavery candidate? I do not so mean. We must have, though, a man who recognizes the slavery issue as being the living issue of the day and who does not hesitate to declare slavery a wrong, nor deal with it as such, who believes in the power and duty of Congress to prevent the spread of it. And in another discovery, after he won nomination in 1860, painters and sculptors descended on Lincoln's hometown to create depictions of the little-known dark horse candidate. The best of the resulting campaign paintings, that done by J.C. Wolfe, inspired mass-produced engravings and lithographs. But then it vanished altogether, until it was recently discovered in the Chicago suburb, hanging in the home of the descendants of a Springfield landlord, in whose building the artist, J.C. Wolfe, lodged and worked. Family lore holds that the artist had no money to pay his rent when he left town and handed over the Lincoln picture to satisfy his debts. In a moment, I discuss the idea of equality with Robert McDonald. This is Talking History.
Thank you.
with me this week for another in our series on the United States Constitution, highlighting a project launched by the Bill of Rights Institute titled Founders and the Constitution, is Robert McDonald. McDonald is a professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point, and he's the editor of Thomas Jefferson's Military Academy, Founding West Point. He also wrote the essay on equality for the Founders and the Constitution series, which is the subject of our conversation today. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks very much, Brian.
Seems to me that you've chosen the most interesting, if only because it remains the most commonly debated, idea expressed by the Founding Fathers, namely the idea of equality. And as you write in the very first sentence of your essay, no single phrase of the Founders is more commonly misinterpreted. So let's start there. What did the Founders mean by the phrase, all men are created equal, and how has it been misinterpreted?
The Founders meant that God endowed all human beings with equal individual rights, and not that they are or ever could be equal in terms of wealth or ability. When Jefferson listed people's rights in the Declaration of Independence, he included life and liberty and the ability of individuals to engage without injuring one another in the pursuit of happiness. So yes, everyone is equal in the sense that everyone has the right not to have his life or his freedom or his property taken against his will. But no, John Adams, who was 5'7", would never be equal in height to Thomas Jefferson, who was 6'3".
That's a good point. Okay, you write that Jefferson's belief in the equality of natural rights reflected a deeply rooted Anglo-American tradition. Explore those roots for me just briefly.
Well, Jefferson's words echoed the reasoning of John Locke, the English political philosopher who, in 1689, maintained that no one, no matter how powerful, possesses the right to take away without just cause, and these are Locke's words, the life, liberty, health, limb, or goods of another. In an age of absolute monarchs, this was a radical position. But after the rise of the Parliament in Britain and throughout the 18th century in both Britain and America, the idea that all had an equal right to be protected from harm became a widely accepted and common sense proposition.
Nevertheless, despite all this tradition, you write that Jefferson's assertion regarding natural rights also sanctioned a radical departure from the past. So how did that come about?
I think in two ways. The first was the idea of equality under the law, and the second was his egalitarian attitude. As far as equality under the law is concerned, it's probably good to start with the idea of religion. There were a number of colonies and then states after independence that had established churches, churches that received subsidies or special protections from the colonial or state government. And Jefferson thought that this was clearly pretty wrong, that people of one faith should not be forced against their will to subsidize the faith of others. And so Virginia in the 1780s became the first of all the states to disestablish its official church. In other words, to create a free religious marketplace. Massachusetts would be the last to follow in the 1830s. Jefferson also worked to reform inheritance laws. There was a law of primogeniture in Virginia. And when Jefferson was in the legislature there and then as governor, Jefferson did away with the primogeniture law, which meant that before this law was done away with, one would receive the wealth of his father if one happened to be lucky enough to be the firstborn son. After this primogeniture law, all the property would be distributed equally among the children, provided that there was no will saying otherwise. And so what this did was kind of level the playing field for people in Virginia. Land would be more evenly distributed. People would be more equal in terms of their wealth. But I think it was in terms of attitude that the spirit of egalitarianism really came through the most. People around America were observed after the American Revolution, especially by foreigners, to think that they were somehow much more equal than people other places would have thought. I guess a good example is an account by Joseph Priestley. Priestley, he was an English theologian, came over to Pennsylvania and wrote a letter back home about the servant girl who worked for him and for his wife. And he said that she claimed that she worked for them, but that she was nobody's servant, that she worked essentially for herself, and that she carried herself with all the stateliness and self-confidence of a queen. So this is kind of a new American spirit that people are beginning to see here, but not elsewhere.
Okay, good examples. But you also write that a couple of concerns had to be dealt with first before the idea of equality could be more fully pursued. And one was the revolutionary generation's concern with the restraint of government. How did that relate to equality?
Well, the whole point of the American Revolution was that the British government had taken on too much power, that it was destroying Americans' lives, curtailing Americans' liberty, and stealing Americans' property. The founders thought not only that America should be self-governing, but also that individual Americans, all of whom were free at least, should have the right to govern themselves and their own actions to the greatest extent possible. And for this principle to work, for it to endure and not get compromised, it would have to be applied to all. If only some were immune from oppression, pretty soon nearly everyone would be oppressed.
Okay. You write that the Founding Fathers believed that before anyone could or should participate in a Republican government, they had to be virtuous and, quoting directly from you, disinterested. Explain that and how that relates again to the idea of equality.
That's a great question. Essentially, the Founders believed that people should be disinterested in that if they were going to be given the franchise, if they were going to be given the power to vote or the power to hold office or the power to participate in the government of others, it should be clear and it should be certain that they were able first to govern themselves. And they should be able to govern themselves sufficiently so that they could support themselves completely. Jefferson had this idea that in a perfect world, everyone would be a farmer. Everyone would be able to grow his own crops and procure from the earth all that he needed to sustain himself and his family. This, Jefferson thought, would make it possible for people to participate in government, to engage their community in a selfless way. They wouldn't be seeking to exploit anyone else. They wouldn't have any great need or any great desire to gain wealth from the experience of governing. They wouldn't be able to be corrupted. They wouldn't be able to be bought off cheaply by someone else who waves some cash in front of them. So this sort of age-old belief that people should own at least a certain degree of property in order to vote is something that certainly carried on through the founding generation and influenced their views about who should be included within this new equal republic.
Okay, that may make it difficult to enfranchise the poor, but how would the idea of disinterestedness apply to women or, for that matter, slaves?
Well, it's a fantastic question because this, I think, really was the great conundrum for the revolutionary generation. Women were assumed almost by definition to be interested, to not be independent, to be dependents upon their husbands or upon their fathers. It was assumed in a sexist way that women would not be able to run a farm, that women would not be able to economically sustain themselves. So all states except New Jersey for a very, very brief time in the 1780s automatically precluded women from having the franchise, from having the right to vote. Slaves were by definition dependents. The idea that a slave or even an emancipated slave could have the vote struck the founding generation as an absurdity. The idea that someone could go from being so dependent that they didn't even own their own body, that they didn't even own their own life, that they could go from that sort of state to a state where they could stand up on their own two feet and make objective and dispassionate decisions about the government of their nation, that struck the founders as inconceivable.
What you're really describing here is equality as a work in progress, as far as inclusivity is concerned anyway. A major concern early on, and I would think a notable accomplishment, however, was equal protection under the law. Tell us about that.
It's something that's so important that we are lucky enough today to take it for granted. But back in the 18th century, it was something that no one would take for granted. I mean, the history of the world is really a history of oppression. It's a history of people assuming power under the guise of governments and using that power to exploit other people. But here in America and under the British during the colonial period, we had early on accepted this idea that the law should be impartial, that the law shouldn't pick on everyone, that everyone should be judged under the same laws. And essentially that tradition followed through during the colonial period and through the American Revolutionary period. It was one of our most cherished principles, I think, that if a certain law could apply to a common man on the street, that same law should apply to a person wielding political power, even at the highest level.
You mentioned the English Bill of Rights in your essay, something with which some of our listeners may not be familiar. Describe that document, what was in it, and how it compared to our Bill of Rights.
The English Bill of Rights was written immediately after Britain's glorious revolution of 1688 and 1689, when they overthrew one monarch and brought in William and Mary, who agreed to listen to the Parliament and respect the Parliament's right to take part in governance. And the English Bill of Rights was written to placed sort of a permanent barrier between the monarchy and the people. It listed certain things that governments could not do. Governments, for example, could not unlawfully restrict the right of people in England to bear arms. I think the idea was that they would be able, if necessary, to rise up and have another glorious revolution that would overthrow a despotic government. The Bill of Rights made it illegal for the monarch to suspend the regular meetings of Parliament. It made it illegal for the monarch to take away the right of the people to petition the government to change. So all of these rights that were recognized on the part of the government in Britain, recognized as being inherent rights of the people, all of these rights in the Americans' views applied to them in America as British subjects. And these are rights that were again codified in our Bill of Rights, which was ratified in 1791.
I want to end this conversation by taking us forward from the Founding Fathers to today. And we can do this by returning to where we began, really, with the changing idea of equality over time. But let me set up the question a bit. Earlier, you noted that the founding of the nation, the idea of equality, referred mostly, if not entirely, to equality of rights or protection under the law. This provided the Founding Fathers with cover, if you will, to exclude from full participation in government women, slaves, and even the poor. Eventually, we'd become more inclusive. We'd begin to talk about equality more in terms of what we describe as equality of condition. And that takes me to the concluding sentence in your essay that in the early decades of the new nation's history, Americans abandoned old notions that paid deference to the inherited aristocracy of wealth and privilege and embraced instead what Jefferson described as a natural aristocracy of talents and virtue. Now, that does not necessarily embrace equality of condition. Has our view of equality changed? And from what you know of Jefferson, how would he have responded to this change?
I think that our view of equality has changed since 1776, but I think that Jefferson probably did as much as anyone to change it. Before the American Revolution, Brian, most people accepted that some would be poor, some would be rich, some would have the power, and others would not. Jefferson disagreed with this notion and championed equality of opportunity. I think one of his pet projects, after all, was education. And he established not only West Point and the University of Virginia, but also he fought for universal public education for all children in Virginia. The idea is that people should cultivate their gifts and make the most of them, that neither the government nor society should get in the way of people who want to work hard to achieve their dreams. Is this equality of condition? It isn't, no. But some people succeeded more than others. That's never going to change. But what was new for Jefferson and the people of his generation was the idea that everyone had a right to try to improve their condition. And I think that nearly all Americans still agree.
Great. That's where we're going to have to leave it then. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Brian.
I've been speaking with Robert McDonald, professor of history at the United States Military Academy and editor of Thomas Jefferson's Military Academy, Founding West Point. He's also the writer of the essay on equality for the Founders and the Constitution series. This is Talking History. Founders in the Constitution, in their own words, includes 24 units, each dedicated to a specific founder. Our guest this week, Robert McDonald, with whom we just spoke, prepared the following brief introduction to Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson hoped that he would be remembered for three accomplishments: his founding of the University of Virginia, his crafting of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, and his authorship of the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson believed that these achievements were the high points of a life dedicated to the promotion of human freedom. Education, he held, freed the mind from ignorance. Tolerance freed the will from coercion. and the assertion of human liberty and equality freed the body from the chains of tyranny. Despite his wishes, however, it is Jefferson's authorship of the Declaration of Independence that has by itself secured his place in history. A member of the Second Continental Congress, Jefferson was appointed to the committee in charge of drafting the document. The other committee members chose Jefferson to do the actual writing. No one else wanted the job. Some thought it a mere formality. Besides, there were more pressing matters. In the summer of 1776, then, when the lanky Virginian penned the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, a nation was born, and Jefferson's name was engraved upon the hearts of his countrymen for all time. Jefferson continued to fight for liberty after America achieved independence. Though he did not participate in the Constitutional Convention of 1787, he played a key role in influencing his friend James Madison to introduce a Bill of Rights in the first federal Congress. He was the first Secretary of State under George Washington. And Jefferson also defended the principle of free speech in the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798. As president, he purchased the Louisiana Territory in 1803 so that Americans could live on the land as independent farmers for 1,000 generations. But Jefferson's actions sometimes contradicted his words. Wary of centralized power, as president he completed the Louisiana Purchase and unhesitatingly employed the resources of the federal government to enforce the harsh and unpopular Embargo Act. A champion of individual rights, he excused the atrocities committed by the French revolutionaries during the Reign of Terror. A critic of slavery who outlawed the slave trade as president, he was the owner of more than 200 African Americans and perhaps the lover of one. The key to understanding Jefferson lies in the difficult task of reconciling the tensions within his life and in his world.
Once again, you've been listening to Robert McDonald, professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point and the editor of Thomas Jefferson's Military Academy, Founding West Point. This is Talking History. Finally, following up on Robert McDonald's remarks on Thomas Jefferson, Kelly Schramm of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University joins us to tell us about a website intended to promote Jefferson's home, Monticello, as a historical site.
Thomas Jefferson recorded in his diary his habit of waking early each day. Whether I retire to bed early or late, I rise with the sun. In 50 years, he wrote, the sun had never caught him in bed. Designed to promote Monticello as a historical site, this exhibit offers a variety of educational and practical information. Materials allow viewers to explore Jefferson's life at Monticello. Particularly interesting is the Day in the Life of Thomas Jefferson, where visitors can learn about a typical day's activities for the third president. Viewers can investigate 11 activities that Jefferson participated in nearly every day, from writing letters to farming. In addition, links with each activity provide background on Jefferson's family, his personality, and Monticello. Another feature is called Ask Thomas Jefferson, where users may submit questions to Mr. Jefferson. Researchers respond to questions in Jefferson's voice using his writings. Users may also take a virtual tour of Monticello, visiting up to 12 rooms in the mansion. The dimensions of the rooms are provided, as well as architectural information, color and design explanations, and a QuickTime panoramic movie. An image gallery contains 65 images, ranging from portraits of Jefferson to photographs of the mansion, from the grounds at Monticello to depictions of his invention. To locate the site, visit www.monticello.org.
That brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Kelly Schrum's review was produced by Schrum and Katarina Herring of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. To learn more about the center, visit its website at gmu.edu. And if you want to learn more about founders and the Constitution in their own words, or if you're interested in seeing a valuable collection of related materials, visit the Bill of Rights Institute website at www.billofrightsinstitute.org. As always, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that our producer is Fiona Beattie, that our studio engineer is Alex Smith, and that the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And finally, we invite you to send us your comments on this show by email, if you wish, to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian Laveau.